So this is a morning talk on retreat, Poplar Grove Zendo, and I'm sitting here with Margie Teja, my wife and companion on retreat, and in front of me are rows of empty cushions. And every morning when I look at the empty cushions, I feel a sweep of sadness. Sadness that you are not here. Sadness that you are not sleeping in our rooms and eating our food and enjoying the thrill of practice together. This kind of sadness is something that appears together with sun coming up, the birds singing, the incense at the front of the room. And it isn't a question of manufacturing some kind of sustained, intense emotion about it. It just appears and disappears. Again, like the sun and the bird call and the incense when it's burnt down. No trace. And so that becomes part of our practice life here. Oh, I'm missing you. Then we just get on with it. Doing our best, sitting alone, chanting alone, walking, preparing food. And in of course, a very tangible way, that's exactly what you are doing wherever you are, whatever household situation you live in. You're doing your best to try and make your life an enlightened one. If I can use the Buddhist terminology. That's what you're doing at home. You're sitting when you can sit. You're listening to the news when you listen to the news. You're preparing your food. You're teaching the children. You are looking after the neighbors. So our practice here, your practice there, same thing. And the little stabs of sadness that you are not here is equally balanced by the appearance of great appreciation for your own situation. And of course, our life is essentially to live it wherever we find ourselves. It's not a question of making a judgment on it. This is better, or that's worse, or this is too difficult, or that's too privileged, or whatever. Whatever judgment categories we apply. It's simply each of us walking where we find our feet, on the ground under our own feet, swinging our own arms. And when we give ourselves to that, without hesitating, without being tied up in complaint and comparison, then everything is just complete as it is. That's it. It's not, from that perspective, it's not difficult. It's not easy. It's just walking where I walk, looking at the hedge that's beside me, under the sky that is above me. There's often a sense that, and I'm just saying this by the way because it strikes me this morning, that when we stand outside and look at our lives under lockdown, it should have certain characteristics. It should be charitable. There should be good works. Those of us, and most of us listening to this talk, will be relatively privileged. That somehow that should be enacted and honored in the way we look after others. And of course, that is 100% correct. But we also have to take care that we're not standing outside our practice, as it were, judging what should be done or what's socially or politically correct from the outside and applying that to our practice. Because sometimes the practice of wholeheartedness asks of us to sit down and be still. And sometimes it asks of us to step outside and help someone across the street or take them food or sing them a song. So there's often, I often get letters written to me by people saying they feel they should do more for others during this time. And in one respect, of course, that's a natural, beautiful concern. I think we just have to be awake to the pressure, the social pressure around us as to what is good according to social norms and what isn't, what is approved and what is not approved. So part of our alertness and awakeness in our practice is to just have a sense of how often we are pushed into certain kinds of reactions because of that kind of external judgment. And that's whether it comes from opinions in the newspaper or on social media, or whether it comes from some Buddhist magazine that tells you how to get rid of anger, racism, privilege, sexism, or whatever kind of ism that you suffer from, and I'm sure you suffer from most of them at some point. So our practice, again, just means coming back to where we are, the reality of where we are, and acting from there, from that open field, as we say, from the blue sky. And we find when we look at our own practice and that of others, that we are often touched by the presence that people bring to a relationship or a moment, regardless of whether it's a charitable act, a good work, or not. The subtleties of life beyond judgment are endless. And sometimes all we need do is be there. Margie and I recently watched a BBC documentary on a Benedictine abbey somewhere in Wales, I think. It was quite a long one. And there was no dialogue at all. It was just following these monks living their life, singing the, what they call the office, singing the hours through the day, and doing their work, sewing robes or making honey or preparing food. And it was absolutely riveting watching people just doing something with meticulous, selfless attention, inspiring to be allowed into that. But let me get back to whatever it was I was talking about. Sadness. Emotion. Different ways of dealing with things. And I think where I was heading was that there is a kind of expectation that we absorb from our environment that says we should be doing certain things, we should look a certain way, we should behave a certain way. But the reality is much stronger than that and much has a quality of beyondness, beyond judgmentness, beyond expectationness about it. And that quality we can only find in the open field, not standing outside trying to evaluate different influences on us or different expectations on ourselves. There's something about the generosity about, a generosity of wholehearted living that is compelling. And when I mentioned the sadness, the feeling of sadness, just the willingness to be that 100% is what allowed it to go, what allowed it to burn itself up and to leave no trace. There are two other instances of sadness that strike me as I talk. May have something to do with the times we're living in. Of course, there is the threat of death and illness all around us in the public mind. It hasn't struck us yet, Margie and me, yet, but there's no doubt that it may at any moment. But I'm reminded of two recent instances where friends of ours died not to do with coronavirus, just died really of old age. We're getting into that territory now. As they say in Afrikaans, the queue is getting shorter. We're getting nearer the front of the line now. But an old school teacher of mine died, and he was someone that whose encouragement and mentorship and eventual friendship I've treasured for over 50 years. And when his widow wrote to say that he had died, I went outside, and the early morning winter sun was unbearably beautiful. Another time I recall very strongly was when Margie and I were trying to decide whether to cancel or go ahead with retreats during our autumn season. And we were having difficulty in arriving at a common view on it. I was quite sure things weren't that serious. And she, of course, had made herself better informed and had some serious concerns. And one afternoon, when we have our late summer afternoon nap, which is a beautiful tradition out here, I woke up to an image of someone in our Sangha, and I can't even say who, just being devastatedly disappointed at not being able to come to retreat. And I was so struck by this that I cried out. My sadness with his or hers was absolute. And because it was absolute, it could disappear. And it was only then that we began to be able to talk about the future of retreats during coronavirus with any sense of a common vision. And then it appeared very simply that we needed to cancel them. And that's what we did. Sometimes there's a sense that one should be more kind of strategic about emotion or compelling or thoughts that are churning in oneself, and that one should apply a kind of mindfulness to them as a tactic, so that you can see it and then allow it to go. I always had some difficulty with that, mainly probably because I couldn't do it. But also because there was some kind of judgment behind it, saying, you really need to make it go now. Sadness is the work of the self, and the self is the work of the devil. So be mindful, and then you will achieve your goal. I know I'm caricaturing it a bit, but that's how it felt to me. That's how it felt to me. But in fact, a wholehearted mindfulness is itself very pure and natural part of wakening up. Just as becoming 100% sad is a natural part of waking up, or 100% angry. Even if these words are associated with the life of the self and the suffering that goes with it. Margie and I once saw a documentary on a young Reverend Desmond Tutu. Who was visiting black people who had been moved from their homes near East London, I think, into desolate reaches of the Siskai, where there was just nothing. And their houses, such as they were, had been offloaded in the middle of nowhere from big trucks and just lay in piles. It was an astonishing picture of this young priest just devastated with sadness and just completely furious. He talked later of righteous anger. But as I understand what he was meaning, is not an external sense of what anger is justified and what isn't. What's good anger and what isn't, making that sort of decision, judging it from the outside and certain emotions being, as it were, acceptable. It's rather that the complete 100% diving into that anger and indignation without reserve at all is what made it righteous, is what made it irresistibly compelling. And that's what enabled him in that situation also to go to one of the white policemen who were standing there and saying, "Good afternoon, officer. This is terrible." An interaction just shot through with honesty and integrity and love. So my feeling on retreat, and it often is of this incalculable worth of what we're doing. And again, it's not because it is right and other ways are wrong. As I say, the practice of mindfulness has its own beauty and its own dangers of attachment, of course. just as this one does. And it's always struck me that Zen teachers often talk about the recitation practice of the Lotus Sutra as very compatible with Zen. The practice I'm talking of is one that arose in medieval Japan and consists of chanting the title of the Lotus Sutra. The reasoning behind it was that the Lotus Sutra summed up the entire corpus of Mahayana Buddhism, and that simply to recite the title somehow incorporated all of that wisdom. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. That's the practice. And from the outside, particularly with a Western mindset, possibly, it looks quite incompatible with Zen practice. It looks sort of intellectually suspect and a bit superstitious. But a number of Zen teachers talk of this as a beautiful form of selfless practice. And it can only be the completeness of giving oneself away into that that is the heart of it. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Whatever we do, 100% is the expression of this Buddha world. Again, I'm using language of the Lotus Sutra. You can find your own words. And it's really the same in our lives. Sometimes we have friends or a spouse or child or parent who belongs to a different religious tradition. Maybe they're a Baptist. Can we go to the Baptist church with them? Can we support them in their life and sing our heart out? Jesus loves me, yes, he knows. I can't remember it anymore. Can our lives be that selfless that we will go with our friend for the very friendship of it and just stand next to them and sing? With no reservation or hesitation or intellectual bracketing of what we're doing. Then there's nothing that's really threatening. Can we go with our friends to watch baseball, even if we tell ourselves we hate baseball, or rugby, or funerals? Whatever it is. So again, I've moved a bit from the theme of sadness, but it feels that everything I want to say comes back to the same point. How do I live my life wherever I am, whatever it is, not stand outside it and make judgment? And sometimes it feels impossible, and that impossibility is part of my life. that difficulty, this uncertainty, this fear that comes with a pandemic of global proportions, how do I live that life that appears now? Our ancestors did it. People waiting for the Cossacks, waiting for the Gestapo to knock on the door, waiting for the conquistadores to land on their boats, waiting for the secret police, waiting for a betrayer in the family. As the Buddha said, the first noble truth is suffering. Our difficulties, where we resist, where we find ourselves feeling that life is impossible, that's the beginning of our practice. Meaning, that's where we step into the water. It's not the enemy of practice, it's the opportunity for practice. As Oscar Wilde once wrote, wherever there is sorrow, there is holy ground. So, thank you for listening. Thank you for not listening. Thank you for staying awake. Thank you for falling asleep. My own teacher, my own Zen teacher, the late Sasaki Roshi, used to say at his Teisho, meaning his Dharma talks, the only people who understand me are those monks who are falling asleep on their cushions. Wonderful. Please have a wonderful day wherever you are, and we will do the same here. Thank you. Thank you.